I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Welcome to the Krishna Dass Pilgrim Heart Hour. In this podcast, Krishna Dass shares his warm-hearted and down-to-earth path to the divine. If you are interested in supporting Krishna Dass's podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/KD.
This is beautiful bhajan that sung by one of the great singers of India, Bhimsen Joshi. It says, "Oh Lord, I've gone to all the puja, all the tirthas, all the sacred places. I've done all these practices and taken your name, and still the vasanas of my own mind, the tendency of my own mind to keep running down the same dirty old streets. Just, I can't stop it." Tulsidas wrote this great poem. It's on the cover of one of my CDs, I forget. He said, "I speak to he says, he's talking to Ram, and he says, you know, anybody have that CD with them? The One Track Heart? She's got everything, this woman. "I speak to Hanuman. Thus, I speak to King Ram, the perfect gentle one. I speak to Shiva himself, the ocean of grace. Be aware and listen, all, of joy and sorrow, love and anger, of virtue and vice, has the Creator made all, of time and nature and fate. Ram is the doer. God is the doer. So I have known this truth, having dwelt upon it in my heart. O Lord, only quench this moping and grieving. What is there that you can't do? Ah, well, let me grow silent, knowing that I reap what I have sown." That's it. See ya. That's it, you know. Where was that gentleman that was talking about free will yesterday? Is he still here? Or did he take his free will and went somewhere else? We think we have free will, and so we act that way. But, you know, like people say to me, I can smoke cigarettes. I have free will. I can do what I want. Yes, you can. But why would you do something that you know is going to fucking kill you? That's free will? No, it's already a conditioned response to something in the past. So it's not a free choice. Free will means being able to make a choice that isn't conditioned by the previous situation. Free will means being able to flow in any direction you want, not just in those channels that we always flow down habitually. So it looks like free will to us, but a lot of things look like a lot of things to us. Of time and nature and fate. All this. You know, and the feeling of sitting with Maharaji was that he was completely beyond all that. And when we were with them, we all had this feeling of total sense of fearlessness and security, that nothing bad could happen, and that anything that happened, whatever it was okay, because if it happened, it had to happen. And that the feeling was that he was so on top of it all, that anything that happened, he either did it himself or he allowed it to happen because it needed to run that way. Like that story I told yesterday about Ed and Chris. There was a lot of things like that. But it's not so easy to maintain that, to live in that kind of presence and that kind of awareness with that kind of openness to everything. And when he left the body, I totally lost it, you know, for years and years and years. Because it's just so, it was as if the Westerners were on this train, right? The train of our lives. And it stopped at this station, and we looked out the window, and there was Maharaji. So we all ran off the train. And we're hanging out with him, having a great time, you know? And then something happened, and we found ourselves back on the train, you know? But everything was just a little bit different because we'd been with him. And don't give me that bullshit about, I want a guru with a body, I want to have somebody. That's nonsense. He wasn't the body. If he was the body, he would be gone and I wouldn't be here. And I don't live in memory of him. That's not enough. I live in presence of him. Now. And that's available for you too. What's stopping you? Your mind. That's all. Your thoughts, your beliefs, your conditioning. So, uncondition yourself. Take that well of balsam and throw it out the window. We're all conditioned because we've been brought up in Western culture. We don't brought up not believing in anything. Nothing. We don't believe in anything. We believe in Cheerios and Mickey Mouse and hamburgers. That's what we believe in. Why not? That's what we dropped into that. Well, that's, we grew up that way. What's wrong with that? Nothing. But there's one saving grace. Suffering. That's what does it. That's what does it. That's what Buddha's talking about. He's not saying, oh, it's all so terrible and it's always going to be terrible. He says, no matter what you do, it's going to be not enough. Dukkha is actually, it's translated as suffering, but it's also, it actually means the unsatisfactory nature of stuff. Nothing is going to be enough. Ever. That's the way it's made. It's not supposed to be enough. Tough. It's a tough one since we're brought up in this romantic ideal that one love, one heart. Elvis was a maniac. He was a totally depraved human being. But everybody go, Elvis, I love, I want that. Good luck. It's in our, I mean, it's just so deep in us, though. It's hard. It's really hard. They have that in India, too. Everybody's in love with all the Bollywood movies and all the fantasies and everything. But they have nothing else, so they need something. We got everything. That's what, when we got to India, the people there, they couldn't believe. They said, what are you people doing here? You know, you have everything in America. We had everything but the one thing we needed. And we all know what it is. You got to recognize that you know exactly what you want. You want that love. That's what you want. That's what we're all looking for. We look for it everywhere, all the time, in everybody that we meet. Is this the one? He the one? She the one? Everybody's the one. We're all one. But we're looking with our emotions. So, you got to get beat up. That's it. You get beat up, then you heal up, and then you get beat up again. Then maybe you just hesitate before you get back in the ring a little bit, you know. Just like, nah, okay. Okay. So. But that's what practice is about. That's what the path is about. Deprogramming ourselves from the way our minds and our emotions work all the time. And beginning to recognize that those programmed responses and programmed fantasies and ideas we have about life may not be true. And if they're not true, then what is true? That's what we have to find. Bhagavad Gita is a pretty good book, you know. There's really some beautiful stuff in there. It's worth reading. Because it's just the bottom line. Simple, clear, boom. So you read it and then you forget again. Read it again. And again. And you don't have to chant it in Sanskrit because you don't understand it. Read it in English. There's some good translations. There's a whole bunch of translations. They all have their own bias. Every translator is trying to sell his philosophical beliefs by using Krishna's words. It's great, you know. But the one I like the best is from Christopher Isherwood and Swami Prabhavananda. I think it's called something stupid like How to Know God or something like that. Is that what it's called? It's a very sweet, and Christopher Isherwood really knew how to use the English language. He was a great writer. And his Swami was a very good Swami. That's a good one. There's other good ones. And then there's this one book which is so extraordinary that it's hard to believe. And it's called The Yoga of the Bhagavad Gita. And it's written by a guy named Sri Krishna Prem, who was an Englishman who went to India when he was maybe 20 years old to teach at a university. And he taught there for many years. I think he was teaching history or something like that, or English literature or something, back in the days of the English in the 20s and 30s. And he lived in the house with his department head and his department head's wife, and he became a member of their family. And he and the wife of his department head developed a secret guru-disciple relationship. And after the old man died, he and the department head's wife went off to the Himalayas and bought a little piece of land and built a Krishna temple and lived there the rest of their lives. And this guy's, he's brilliant, just absolutely brilliant. And he wrote a series of articles for a magazine in India that later became this book. And it's extraordinary. Really, I remember back in 1969, we were up in Lama Foundation for the winter, and Ram Dass, we would read this book every day out loud, and it completely rewired my brain. It's so intense. Some of it's a little bit old-fashioned writing, you know, a little fancy, but it's extraordinary. It's really just clear and clean and just exactly what it is. It's a beautiful book. So, the name of the book is The Yoga of the Bhagavat, with a T at the end, Gita. But if you just search Sri Krishna Prem, you'll find it. I think it's in paperback now. It's hard to find. And they printed it in India, but it's not printed in America anymore. I collect some of the old copies from the 30s and 40s, you know. These old books that smell like shit, you know. I love them. I love those old books. All right. Any questions or anything? Let us get organized here. Where's the mic, people? Oh, they went to Eckhart Tolle's place? They're in the now somewhere else. Go, Lisa.
Morning.
Hi.
I came to see you, I guess, January of last year up at the Garrison Institute.
Garrison.
And I was inspired by the Hanuman Chalisa session. And I said, after a year of trying, this is the year I'm going to learn the Chalisa.
Mm-hmm.
And so 2015 was a great year, and I still don't know how to sing it. But I have a real problem. And during the Chalisa, I don't know when to swallow.
You don't know what to swallow?
Well, it's 40 lines, and you're trying to sing the whole time, and all of a sudden you've got all the saliva in your mouth, and you're like, I can't spit it out, and I can't swallow because I got to stop singing. And I never hear you pause, so how do you do it?
Pray for grace. You'll find a way. Or you'll die, one or the other. Or both. You find a way. You do quick little swallows, quick little breaths. And you don't have to sing the Chalisa. You can read it. It doesn't have to be memorized. People in India don't know it. Many of them read it. You know, most of the prayers they read also because it helps concentration. Helps you pay attention. It doesn't have to be sung. It can be just spoken or chanted without melody. Whatever. And get some tissues or something. You got schmutz all over your beard there. Yeah.
So I just want to say that guy's not crazy. I told my wife the same thing yesterday. While Nina was singing.
Yeah, but you're married. She has to drool on you.
But my question is, I recently retired, and I found that I was reflecting back on where I've come from, and now that I'm entering a different phase, I start to reevaluate everything that I've done. As you get close to your break, do you find yourself doing such a thing? What do you think back on? What are the things that move you? What has brought you to this point?
My break starts in an hour and 14 minutes. As far as reflecting on the past, it doesn't reflect very well. So I don't think about that much, you know. I'm too tired to think about it. Except when I'm really moping around, you know, I don't really think about myself that much. I've given up trying to understand me. It's useless. So I just keep moving in whatever direction I happen to be moving, whether it's up or down, I don't know. But, you know, we think a lot, you know. We wake up in the morning, and all day long, all we do is tell ourselves stories about everything that's happening, react to things, and there's very little awareness there. And once you start making some space in that endless flow of thought, you kind of start to crave that, you know. Part of you realizes this is the only place you can breathe, you know, when you drop into a quiet place. And you start to crave that more. And so sometimes I find myself just sitting around, you know, without the TV on, without music, without anything. I'm not even doing, you know, nothing. I'm just kind of, it's interesting, you know. But we have to kind of put some effort into slowing down and to Mr. Tiwari used to say, evaluative mind is like being on a boat heading to the rapids over a waterfall and thinking that the bank of the river is moving and you're sitting still. You know, we have the complete incorrect view of things all the time. In our view, me is the most central thing in the universe, and everything revolves around that and reflects around that and relates to that. Everything everybody does, everything Trump says, it has something to do with me. And we're always... And the thing that we're doing is we're always locating ourselves by kind of recognizing things and placing ourselves in a position to things that we see or think or feel or appear to notice in the outside world. We're positioning ourselves. We're fine. And the actual truth is there's nothing there. Position. except the thoughts of doing that. It's a very crazy thing. But all we do is think. And we think, and we think, and we think, and we think we're thinking all this time. You know, but they say there's really nobody thinking. It's just thoughts. There's no one person in there. There's not like a little tiny little you that looks just like you and it's in the center of your head. That's what's really thinking all that stuff. It's not there. There's nothing in there, you know. And when you start doing more practice and start repeating mantra and repeating the name and get used to letting go of the thoughts and just coming back to the repetition, you start to spend, time will go by when you're just aware of the repeating of the name and you're not thinking that meta thought of like, wow, I'm really doing this, or here I am repeating the name. That won't even be arising. You'll just be Ram, 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 Ram. And you won't be thinking that you're doing it. The thought of I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this won't arise. That's closer to what's to reality. Like I told you that whole story about the name being a seed and how the house is destroyed. This house is me. And just like a house, it's a temporary structure that was put together by certain causes and conditions. It's temporary. The whole feeling of being separate from the rest of the universe, that's what they call Maya. That's illusion, delusion. We're really not separate. Really, like Maharaj used to say, sub ek, there's only one. It's all one. There's only one of us. But we've got all these little, tiny little me's looking out of all these eyes, thinking, yeah, that's me. I'm the one. No. But that's okay, you know. I recognize that it's okay to be stupid. It really does. It's okay. When you're stupid and you think that you're really yourself, it's okay. Because you won't always think that. Time will come when you recognize what the truth is. That there's only love everywhere in all directions all the time. That's all there is. And we don't have to grab it because there's nobody to grab it. We are it. And you don't have to make yourself believe that. It's not like you don't have to manipulate your emotions to have some kind of experience like that. That yes, I'm all love. I'm love. And you don't have to repeat, I'm love, I'm love, I'm love, I'm love. You know, because that part of you isn't love. That part of you is your mind saying, I'm love, I'm love, I'm love. It's not very loving. So you just do your practice, live your life, and deal with whatever arises as best you can. That's it. And I'm going to deal with lots of time at home. Probably not as much as I want. But
hi again. Thanks.
Where are you?
I'm right here. Sorry.
Hi.
Hi. Yesterday you talked. Thank you for a lovely weekend, by the way. I think we've all really enjoyed one another, and I know I have. I was listening to your
Kev, turn it up.
Response yesterday about someone had told you about the moment of conception. What were your parents thinking? What were they eating? What were they doing? You know, that kind of thing. And you know, my personal example, just for purposes of this conversation, is I know my mother had an abortion, and then she had me. They got married 2 weeks before I was born, I think. And then, you know, they divorced when I was two or something like that. So a lot of my stuff, which I know you encourage us to go to therapy and work it out, in addition to the practice, which I do both, you know, now in today's Mickey Mouse world and modern age, we can choose sort of to have families or not, to have kids or not. We may not choose a love relationship, but I think I speak for a lot of women in my situation who can choose to have children or not. So last year I froze my eggs. A few years ago I chose to not freeze embryos, like I didn't want a sperm donor. So my question about all of this is sort of like, where do you sort of fit in with this idea of not wanting to insert yourself into the karma, right? Because if I'm not supposed to have kids, then I won't have kids. Or inserting yourself into the karma if you're in a position to have the choice to potentially manifest. Because I don't want to necessarily repeat what's happened for all the ancestors and generations before me. And if it's supposed to end here, then let it end here. And yet at the same time, if I can sort of find my way on the path to a place where I can be self-aware enough to fully parent myself before I can parent the child that I would have biologically, then is it okay to, not is it okay, but, you know, whatever, to sort of introduce a child into the world given that situation? Anyway, thanks.
I don't know. I don't think it's a question of right or wrong. But first, let's be real here. You know, it'll take you the rest of your life to even begin to parent yourself. So if you're waiting for that, then I'd say, you know, pull the plug on the freezer. Because that's not going to happen. Everything we do is programmed response already, you know. The only thing that's going to save us is practice. And that's not overnight. That's not even a year or two. It's a lifetime. It's many lifetimes of work. So, but that's, nobody really expects us to be free before we act, because then everybody just be sitting there like this their whole lives. So you follow your heart, you do what you feel is right for you. That's all you can do. And that's, the work is trying to figure out what that is, and that's your path. That's everybody's path, is trying to find out what's right for them and what will be the best thing for your life. And we can't wait for a moment to try to understand it all before acting. That's not going to come. We might think we feel that way, but that's just something we're doing to give ourselves the excuse to act in a certain way or other. We'll never understand it. We never know what we're doing. We never know where we are. We never know how we're doing. All the judgments about ourselves are conditioned responses, looking through very colorful glasses. So all we can do is do the best we can, whatever that means to you. Nobody can tell you. It's completely and totally up to you to find what's right for you. And honesty is the most important part of that equation. And that's the hardest thing to be with ourselves, since we don't know who we are. What are we being honest about, you know? It's tricky. So, when my daughter was born, that was a big thing. Because I see there's a mouth to feed more than once a day, every day, for a long time. It was a serious wake-up call. I actually got a job. You don't even know what it was. Where's Bub? Is he here? Yeah, we were cleaning a place called Pig by the Tail. You walk into this place and you slip and fall because there's so much fucking pig grease on the floor. And then there's big pig grease boogers on the walls and the heads of stuffed pigs on the counter. And I've been a vegetarian already for like 30 years. Hello, little piggy. It's like, yeah. But luckily, after that, I go across the street to the chocolate, the French charcuterie, the French chocolate bakery, and I'd eat all the truffles and stuff. And so you know, it's one thing leads to another. And when you're trying to be honest with yourself, you have to kind of take all that into account, you know, because there's a lot of, you might feel this way today, but in 2 years, you might have regrets. You might think you did the wrong thing. You just never know what you're going to feel later, so you have to be really as clear as you can with yourself in the now, knowing that you'll never know anyway. I mean, there's no moment of ultimate clarity until you're God, which you already are, but you don't know that. So. Yeah, my daughter managed to eat every day of her life. It's amazing. I don't know how that happened. All right, we'll get back there after this. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Could you speak on how you're able to live in the presence of Maharaji or anyone else who's not actually in their body? I have a struggle with that. So I know earlier you spoke on it a little bit, but if you could just speak on it a little more.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. Well, in the first place, we are not the body. You know, it's a consciousness that's living temporarily in this broken down old car. You know? And that's, the more you know that about yourself, the more you can recognize that a great being is much more conscious of that than we are. But we're identified with our bodies, so it's very difficult to imagine what it would be if we weren't, you know, because this is all we know. It's like you've been driving around in a 1948 DeSoto. Yeah, you don't even remember a DeSoto. And then, you know, you just can't imagine a car that goes more than 30 miles an hour. But they exist. So. There are many kinds of bodies, you know, and you could say, too. When you're asleep at night and you're dreaming, in that dream you have a body. You're cruising around doing all kinds of stuff. And there's other people in the dream, too. They're all part of your mind, though. They're not really the other people. And then when you wake up, that body's disappeared. But you're still here. So these great beings, it's like that even on another level, after level. They're just like we think this is reality, and when we're asleep and dreaming, that's just a dream. They know this is just a dream. And reality is where they live, because they've already woken up. We're asleep. And this is just another level of dream. But it's the dream that we share with all these other people, it seems. I'm beginning to wonder. Never mind. So. But in the dream, you think it's real, you know. And just like we think this is real. But so because we think this is real, that's where you are. You're not over there. You're not somewhere else, right? But when you wake up in this dream, there's, you know. So you're locked up in that body, but really, it's just a dream. And those beings are awake. so they're present everywhere. We're in their dream. You know, they're dreaming us. And in fact, they say that the rishis sat around together at night by the fire and told each other stories. And this is what they told each other. Us. And the stories they told each other, each one of them was in charge of a different avatar, so to speak. And he would tell the story of the avatar and create this whole drama so beings like us could live out our karmas and become free inside that drama. They wrote the drama, and we're part of what they wrote. In other words, we've taken on this role in this life. Each of us has our own role, right? You're you, I'm me. That's your role. But how did this drama get produced? You know? Where did we get the stage to act out on? Right? Our lives, this whole world. Well, it was created by the minds of these great beings, in order that our karmas, which needed to be fulfilled, could take form as you and you and you and you and me, and live out our lives, live out our stuff, and develop, as Bob Thurman would say, a sense of ethics, a sense of goodness, a sense of caring about others, and generosity of spirit and offering help to other people and trying to recognize other people's needs as well as our own. This is what human beings have that other beings don't have. This a generosity of spirit that is in direct contradiction to survival, self-survival. Like Bob was saying yesterday, we have heroes who, like war heroes, who will, you know, run out and attack and, you know, put their lives on the line to save their company or to save their other soldiers. And that's in direct contradiction to self-survival, which is the most important thing that we basically have. But a person will do that. He'll overcome his programming, genetic programming, to save somebody else. This is a very, very interesting thing. And in fact, one becomes a great saint over time, over thousands and thousands and millions of lifetimes, by continually developing this caring and generosity and giving to other people. Because it's the one thing that human beings can do that other forms of life can't do. Make a decision that's against their, except in certain situations, a mother can try to protect the children. But that's a programmed response. It's beautiful, but it's a program response. So human beings, by going against the, you know, I'm going to feed me first and my own people first, going against that kind of programming is how we develop a wideness of heart. And if you read the stories of the Buddha, and while he was a Buddha, becoming a Buddha, what they call a bodhisattva, life after life after life, he gave up his own life for other people, other beings. And that's how he became a Buddha. And so this whole stage, this drama of our lives, which today we're all sharing, and tomorrow we'll all be in different places, but you'll still be on the stage. Where did the stage come from? You know, they say that the rishis created this. mind, with their minds, the power of their minds. They created this so that beings like us who had karmas to live through could get that work done. This is unimportant. I mean, you don't have to think about this stuff, but it's fun sometimes to just think of, well, how did I even get this life, you know? And what should I do with it? I don't know. I could spend the rest of my time playing Candy Crush. Or maybe I should pay some attention to things. Anyway, yeah, so I don't know how I got started on that, but that's over. Next.
Good morning. Phil, it's such an honor to be here in your presence. I think the way you describe your experience when you were with Maharaji is probably a similar way that I feel when I'm in your presence, and I feel incredibly grateful and blessed for that. I feel that way when you're not with me also, and I hear you, so I'm very, very grateful for that. I wanted to ask you a question that was kind of, it kind of goes on beyond what this young lady had asked you earlier. I feel the presence of some loved ones that were in my life physically that are no longer in their bodies. Mm-hmm. And I have no question of their energy and signs and in a lot of different ways. But I struggle sometimes with thinking about the reincarnation. So, you know, where is this soul? And if this soul then gets reincarnated, is this soul, like, how is it possible that he's still here in this presence with me, but he's also now somewhere else and could be some other object or person or whatever?
The whole problem is that you think you're the body, and you think, We're identified with the physical plane. So when you're identified with the physical plane, there's here and then there's there, and that's somewhere else. But for someone who's not identified with the physical body, that they could be anywhere, everywhere. Why not? That's not. We feel the love is always here. The love never goes anywhere. The bodies continually arise and disappear. Since the beginning of time. They say that all the time. They say, you know, Krishna, his body's gone, Ram's body's gone, but their name is still here. So that's why they say the name is such a powerful thing. And so name, when you think of someone who is no longer in the physical body, you're calling their name. You're locating them in space, in your consciousness. And you feel them. Why not? As far as reincarnation goes, it's a very complicated issue. Very complicated. And they've been arguing about it since day one. What's really reincarnated? Is there really a soul? Is it eternal? Or is it temporary? And where it happened? You know, they've been arguing about this shit for millions of lifetimes, and they'll continue arguing about it. And they say nobody but a fully enlightened being actually understands karma and reincarnation fully. But my dad left the body, but I feel him all the time. You know? Is it really him? Or is it just what I'm feeling? How would I know? How did I know it was really him sitting there watching TV with me? It looked like him because that's who I thought he was. Right? And now that's not there. Does that mean he's not here? It doesn't necessarily follow, as far as I can see. Because you think you're like within this like 2 or 3 foot little thing, that everything else is out there, somewhere else. That's just temporary delusion. You know, at night when you go to sleep, you leave your body. You're no longer identified with the body. You might be having dreams where you're somebody else in another place, and And we say, oh, that was just a dream. Well, guess what? That's what this is. But we believe this one. This one seems real, so we call it reality. But, you know. And Maharaji could be in more than one place at one time. That happened many times. So what does it mean? What is a body? Where is that person that you're thinking about? And if one person could do that, one being, well, does it mean, is he the only person in the universe who could ever do that? No. Anybody could do that, given the right situation. Mr. Tiwari told me once they were up in the mountains and there was a celebration of the opening of one of the temples in New Delhi, which was about maybe an 18-hour drive from where they were. And maybe not that much, maybe 14 hours. So, and Maharaji was expected there. So, but they were way up in the hills. So sometime in the afternoon, Maharaji says to Tiwari, let's go, let's take a walk. And they walked out on the ridge of the mountain. And Maharaji says to Tiwari, sit down and meditate. So Tiwari sat down, faced the mountain, closed his eyes. And who knows how long it was. But after some time, Maharaji, come on, get up. You're wasting my time. Let's go. And they went back to the house. So the next morning, some people arrived from Delhi, and they brought a box of prasad from the meal that was served. And they said, Maharaji left before taking his meal, so we decided to come bring it to him. And they said, what do you mean Maharaji left? Just what I said. He was there at the temple, but when it came time to serve the meal, we couldn't find him. And they said, what are you talking about? He was here all day. And the guy looks around and says, no, he wasn't. He was there, and he was there too. He points to Tiwari. Ha, ha. You got to kind of, you know, this seems hard and solid, but, you know, if you look closely enough, it's just molecules and there's lots of space in there. The only place there's any space is in here. Yeah. Where are you? Hi.
Hi. I've been living in Taos and going Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
No, I can hear you now.
I've been living in Taos and going to the Hanuman Temple there. Uh-huh. And I have two questions. First of all, I was wondering why they only sing the Chalisa. And I asked them if they could sing some call and response, and they said it's up to the chanters, and they never do, except on a holiday. And also I was wondering if you could speak a little about the beginning days when you guys started the Temple Lama Foundation and how that all came about.
Oh, I didn't have anything to do with the Lama Foundation. That was other people earlier than me. The temple started in a typical Maharaji way. We decided Ram Dass wanted to get a murti, a statue of Hanuman. So he asked this artist to draw a picture of Hanuman, you know, and then he took it to India, to Jaipur, where they carve these statues out of marble. They've been doing, same family's been doing for hundreds of years, maybe more. So then it got shipped in a big crate to New York. And in those days, there was only one person in the whole satsang who had a house. So somebody went and drove, picked it up in New York and drove it to New Mexico, where the only house in the satsang was. So it sat in the garage. No, it was outside of this guy's house in a big crate. And every year we would go to New Mexico, a lot of the people from India, and we would celebrate, we'd have a bandara. Celebrating Maharaji's Mahasamadhi, leaving the body. And we'd, you know, cook food and have a party. And then we'd all go back to our home. So one year, one of the women had a dream that Hanuman came to her and said, you know, there's a bee's nest around my neck and it's bothering me. So she told this, unfortunately or fortunately, she told it to this guy who happened to be peeking on acid, who decided the best thing to do was jump up on top of the crate of Hanuman and start ripping it up and opening it up. So, and that's in fact what he started to do, and other people joined in, and in fact they found a bee's nest. And then, so now the crate is open, Hanuman's out in the open, something has to happen. So they put him in a garage, and then that guy moved and put him in his other garage, and then the garage kind of became the temple. You see how deeply and we consider things and plan in advance? This is how Maharaji does things. Yeah, he doesn't ask you your permission, and he doesn't ask you to agree. He just does it when the time is right and you find things happening. You know, that's the way it goes. And so that's exactly where Hanuman is right now, in the same place, in that garage. But now it's a huge temple. Now it's a temple. And then they're going to build another temple for Maharaji's tucket, for his bed, in a separate place. You know. And I don't know why they... I haven't been there much lately, so... I guess they sing the Chalisa because, you know, Chalisa is a big thing. Maharaji said every line of the Hanuman Chalisa is Maha Mantra. Maha Mantra means the great mantra, the name. The name of God is Maha Mantra. There are some particular sects of religious groups who say that their mantra is Maha Mantra only, and other names of God are not Maha Mantra. As my grandfather used to say, God bless him. He said, every line of the Hanuman Chalisa is Maha Mantra, and all the names of God are Maha Mantra. The great, the number one hit parade mantra. The mantra that's only good for one thing, making us happy. There are mantras for all kinds of things. Mantras for finding buried treasure. There's mantras for getting people to fall in love with you. There's mantras to become president of the United States. Obama did that one. You know, he carries around a little Hanuman with him, you know, in his pocket. There's mantras for everything, but the name is only good for one thing. That's for finding the love that lives within us. That's all it's good for. So, and he said Hanuman Chalisa can change fate. That's an interesting concept, isn't it? But it shouldn't be done with the idea that I'm really scared I'm going to change my fate, because then nothing will happen. But one should could think of it as if, you know, your life is like a river and there are some rocks down there in the river. So those rocks just kind of get removed without you even knowing it. When you do any practice wholeheartedly, that's kind of what happens. The heavier karmas are dissolved and the things that you need come to you. So let's sing the Hanuman Chalisa and go home. Unless anybody, I'll take another couple of quick questions if there are any. No? Good. Shri Guru Charana Saroja Raja Nijamanu Mukuru Sudhari Varano Raghuvara Vimala Jasu Jodhaku Palachari Buddhihin Tanujanake Sumeron Pavanakuma Balabuddhi Vidya Eo Mohi Arahu Kalesa Bipar Siyavara Ramacham Padaje Sharam Jaya Hanuman Jnana Guna Saga Jekapti Satyo Loka Uja Rama Rita Tulita Baladama Anjani Putra Pavanna Sutra Mahavir Vikram Bajarangi Mati Nivara Sumati Kesangi Kanchana Varana Viraja Subesa Kanana Kuntala Kanchita Kesa Hatha Bajra Dvaja Viraja Kande Munja Jane Usaja Shankara Suvana Kesari Nandan Teja Pratapa Mahajagavan Vidyavan Guni Ati Chatu Makaja Kaimbe Koatu Prabhu Charitra Sunibe Korasya Ramalakana Sita Manabasi Sukshma Rupadari Siya Hindikava Bikata Rupa Dare Lanka Jaya Bhima Rupa Dare Asura Sanhare Ramachandra Ke Kaja Samava Vyasa Jeevana Lakana Jiyaye Shri Raghuvira Rashi Ralaya Raghupati Kinhi Mohottabarai Tumma Mamma Priya Bharatai Sammabhai Sahasabhadan Tumaro Yasaga Asakahi Shri Pati Kantalaga Sanakadika Brahmadi Munisa Narada Sharada Sahita Ahisa Yamakuvir Digapala Jahante Kabhi ko bidda kahe sake kahante Tuma upakara sugriva hinkinha Ramame
Durga Sahasra Chojana Paramana Ilyota Himadura Palajan Prabhu Mudrika Nele Mukamahi Chala Dilangi Gaye Achara Janahi Durgama Kaja Jagatta Ke Jete Sukama Anugraha Tumare Te Te Nama Duare Tumarakavare Ottana Agya Binno Peza Sabasukalahe Tumari Sharana Tumarachaka Kahu Kodara Apana Teja Samharo Ape Dino Loka Hankatin Kampe Utta Pisasha Nakatan Heave Mahavir Javanamasuna Naseroga Hare Sapapira Japatanirantara Hanumatabir Sankatate Hanuma Churave Mana Krama Bachana Nama Jolave Sabaparama Tapasvi Raja Dina Ke Kaja Sakala Tuma Saja Ora Manorata Jo Kovilave Soyam mitta jivana palapale Chano yuga paratapa tumara He parasita jagatta ujiya Sadhu santake tumara kavare Asurane kandana ramadula Ashta siddhi no nidhi ke data Asavara dinha janaki mata Ramarasayana tumare pasa Sadaraho Raghupati Kedas Tumare Bhajana Rama Kopale Janama Janama Ke Dukkha Bisarao Antakala Raghubara Pura Jai Janma Hare Bhakta Kahai Ora Devata Chitana Darai Anumata Sei Sarasukakai Sankata Kate Mite Sabapira Jo sumere hanumata balabir Je hanuman kosai Kripa karo gurudeva kina Jo satapara patakara koi Chuttahi mandi asukhoi Joya pare anumana chalisa, poya siddhi saki harisa, tulasi dasa sada hari chera, ki jenata hridaya mande, pavanatanaya sankata hara. Balamurti Rupa Siyaram Ramalakana Sita Sita Vardaya Surabhupa Siyavara Ramachandra Padadeshara. Mangalamurti Marutanandam Sakala Mangalamulanekandam Mangalamurti Marutanandam Sakala Mangalamulanekandam Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Shri Ram Jai Ram Ram Lakshman Janaki Jai Bolo Hanuman Ki Ram.
Shri Ram Jai.